My talk is on a revisionist history, intellectual history. A few years ago, I gave a lecture on the Eisenhower administration and Eisenhower's economic policy. And while I was writing that lecture, I was surprised to find out that Eisenhower was a lot better than I initially thought. Well, the lecture I prepared today has to do with the New Economists, who are basically President John Kennedy's economic advisors and later President Johnson's economic advisors, Democrats all. And military Keynesianism, the other part of the title, is used today both by people on right and left. Again, I thought I understood what military Keynesianism was prior to preparing this lecture. But in fact, I found out that this is much more monstrous than I initially thought. Just as the New Economists, Kennedy's advisors, were much more evil than I thought. So let me begin with a statement by one of the New Economists, the face of the New Economics, Walter W. Heller. He wrote, "Economics has come of age in the 1960s. Two presidents have recognized and drawn on modern economics as a source of national strength and presidential power." Get that last word, power. "We at last accept, in fact, what was accepted in law 20 years ago, namely that the federal government has an overarching responsibility for the nation's economic stability," that means stopping inflations and especially recessions, "and growth." Okay, and we'll see why that word is so momentous. And he says, "What these are profound changes. What they have wrought is not the creation of a new economics, but the completion, culmination of the Keynesian revolution. And they have put the political economists at the president's elbow." So as we'll see, the new economics is really an economics of power. Who are the new economists? As I said, they were advisors to President Kennedy, both during his campaign and during his administration. They were grouped around the Council of Economic Advisors. They were the staff, outside consultants, the chair, and the members. All held academic positions, and almost all of them held these positions at elite Eastern universities like MIT, Yale, and Harvard. All were leading proponents of Keynesian macroeconomics, it goes without saying. And most important, the leading economists, and this is what I found that's a little bit new, the leading new economists had served in federal government economic planning and research agencies during World War II. Well, actually, that was well known. But what I didn't quite understand at the time, and you know, I've been studying economics for a very long period of time, is that the effect that this wartime experience had on these so-called new economists. Let me just name them, give their academic affiliation, and their wartime service. And it's always important to name names. Murray Rothbard always said you have to name names, especially the bad guys, and because we want to know who's doing what to whom, or who did what to whom. So Walter Heller, University of Minnesota, he was in U.S. Treasury during World War II, advisor of military government of Germany when it was occupied. James Tobin, Yale University, Office of the Price Administration. They were the price controllers during World War II. And the War Production Board. They were the economic planners of production. So he was involved in that agency. Gardner Ackley, University of Michigan, also Office of Price Administration. John Kenneth Galbraith from Harvard University, who was a deputy director or assistant administrator of the OPA. And then his abrasive personality got him kicked out. And he became the director of the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, which was a study of how U.S. saturation bombing improved the Allies' war effort, both of Germany and then later of Japan. And to his credit, he was one of the few people on that board. There were a lot of businessmen and scientists and psychologists even. To his credit, Galbraith pointed out that it did nothing, that it didn't advance the Allied war effort. And they tried to suppress that part of the report, but he insisted that it be published. Basically, They saturation bombed the cities, killed men, women, old men, women, children. But the Germans, of course, had put the all their industrial base on the outside of those cities. Nonetheless, he was very high in the price control administration. Paul Samuelson worked for the MIT Radiation Laboratory. It was a microwave and radar assembly research facility. So they all had this common wartime experience. Michael Bernstein, who was a sympathetic revisionist historian, he was sympathetic to the New Economists, but he did have some good insights. One of which he stated as follows: these men had been wrenched from their professional studies to serve the nation in World War II. They became part of a vast apparatus of federal economic planning that not only had been born of necessity, but also most vividly had worked well, and I would say perceived to be born of necessity and had worked well. It is hardly surprising that they would thus bring to Washington almost two decades later a faith in and commitment to macroeconomic management that was as determined as it was sophisticated, okay? So the New Economics was really an economics of, might call it market socialism or macroeconomic socialism. The New Economists did not merely want to use, and this is the way military Keynesianism is still defined, they didn't want to use Keynesian economics only as they didn't want to categorize it as only a way of spending money on the military, which would get us out of a recession, and just like spending money on bridges, other infrastructure, education, R&D. So military Keynesianism, as it is commonly defined, compares this unproductive spending on war and military to very productive spending, and they say there's no difference. But in fact, one of the New Economists pointed this out early on. This was in the 50s. He said, the major indirect control is the federal budget. The government budget is a major instrument of general economic planning. The other indirect control is monetary policy. Unlike the direct controls of wartime, these measures do not supplant markets or prevent the forces of supply and demand from determining the prices and quantities of goods and services bought and sold. So in other words, it was an attempt at using macroeconomic tools and not price controls and orders and so on to impose socialism on the U.S. economy. It was a macroeconomic approach to socialism. What is military Keynesianism? As I said, it's much more than simply using defense spending to get us out of recessions and unemployment. It combines Keynesian macroeconomics with very arcane growth theory, which was very mathematical and arose and flourished, especially in the early 50s. So they wanted to combine the two to centrally plan the allocation of resources to various sectors of the economy. Okay, if you read the New Economists in the late 50s, when they're beginning to try to influence Kennedy, who looked like he was going to be the candidate, you'll find the following: that the economy was divided into four sectors. Private consumption, bad. Private investment, good. Public consumption and public investment, they like that. And military expenditure. What they wanted to do was to starve the first category, the first sector of the economy, in the interest of the other three sectors. Okay, they wanted to expand government, they wanted to expand the military establishment, they wanted to increase the amount of growth so we could compete with the Soviet Union, and also in the interests of future generations. Why do future generations, why are they privileged over the present generation? Why is present consumption so out of favor with them when in fact in private investment and government investment go to the benefit of future generations, the consumption of future generations. Okay. A main reason that they wanted to increase growth was not only to benefit future generations, but it was they wanted to meet the Soviet challenge, which was a recurring worry of these New Economists. The rhetoric of the new economics, they wanted to dumb down, they dumbed down Keynesian economics into a few basic propositions. One, potential output, which was the amount of GNP, we'd say GDP today, that would be produced by the economy in which labor is fully employed and all plant and equipment is fully utilized. This potential output tends to grow over time as we have more capital investment and improved technology. The output gap. That was the difference between potential output of a fully employed economy and actual output, which tended to fall during recessions below potential output. Okun's law was a statistical law that was came up by one that was formulated by one of the new economists, and it said that a 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate causes output to fall by 2%, because they wanted to measure, they wanted to get a figure in the billions that they could say, look, we've wasted all of this output during the Eisenhower administration, and I'll give you some figures in a moment, because we didn't have fully employed economy. And finally, the full employment deficit. They said, look, don't worry if we have huge deficits now, because as we get the economy back to full employment, the deficit will disappear. We'll have a full employment surplus, because as you increase the amount of employed, you get a reduction in the amount of unemployment insurance paid, a reduction in welfare, and you get more tax receipts. So really, we have to look at the full employment budget, the full employment deficit. There is no deficit if there were full employment. Of course, in the real world right then, in real time, yeah, there was a big, big deficit, or they were in favor of big deficits. So how do you cure this output gap with deficits and more deficits? Okay, that was their recipe. And so to give you the following figures, according to the New Economist, the cumulative real GNP gap for the decade of the 1950s totaled $175 billion. Okay, so this was a sort of a stick used to beat the Eisenhower administration, that they actually caused us to lose $175 billion of goods and services that we could have consumed. One of the New Economists, Okun, estimated the output gap for 1958 to 1963. He estimated that it cost the U.S. economy $200 billion in output. Here's a picture of it. You see that the wavy line is is the actual output. That straight line is the potential output, which is growing over time. So you see the second gap there is where the actual output goes below potential output, because the economy is not fully employed. So they wanted, that was their first goal, was to get the economy to be fully employed. And then once it was on that straight line and was growing, then the deficits would disappear, because you get more tax revenues as people earn more income, and the government spends less on unemployment, welfare, and so on. Okay. Once you got rid of unemployment, they had three other goals, and here's where the market socialism comes in. They wanted to increase the rate of growth of potential output by redistributing resources from private consumption to private investment and government investment in infrastructure, education, R&D, and so on. And this would increase the amount of capital in the economy and would increase the growth rate so that we could compete with the Soviets, and would increase the amount of consumption for future generations. They wanted to enlarge the military sector, again at the expense of private consumption. They wanted to expand the provision of public consumption goods, parks, recreation, conservation, while reducing private consumption of luxury goods. Private consumption was always of luxury goods, if you read The New Economist, whereas consumption in the future, they never really discussed, but they were always worried about these future non-voters. And that green, I direct your attention to the green line. The green line is the way of increasing growth. It's steeper than the regular potential output line there. the straight line that you see, okay? So if you have more R&D, spending on R&D, more capital, and more infrastructure and so on, you get a faster rate of growth. How do you do this, okay? So here's where market socialism really takes hold. Once you've closed the output gap, the new economists advise a tight fiscal policy and an easy monetary policy. In other words, they wanted surpluses. They wanted very high taxes, they wanted surpluses, and they wanted low interest rates. They wanted loose monetary policy to keep interest rates low. So why is that the case? Well, high taxes and budget surpluses could shift resources from the private to the public sector, permitting an increase in government spending on the military and infrastructure, an expansion of the political provision of what we call public consumer goods, conservation, parks, and so on. The surplus would enable government to pay down the national debt, releasing funds to be used for private investment. And you wanted more private investment, again, to increase the growth rate. A tight fiscal policy would also starve the public sector of resources used to produce luxury consumer goods, which would be shifted to the higher priority military and other public uses. And let me give you some quotes on this. Paul Samuelson, who was the most influential economist of the post-war part of the 20th century, he wrote, "I have been preaching the doctrine that a mixed enterprise economy can raise its rate of capital formation and hence the growth rate of potential GNP by supplementing private thrift by public thrift." What does he mean by public thrift? Well, what he means is a chronic surplus, a chronic overtaxation would release resources to investment needs and curtail inflation and reduce the public debt. So in other words, he wanted to heavily tax the population, but use that money to shift to increasing military, increasing the growth rate. Okay, he called it overtaxation. And the surpluses would be used to pay back the bondholders, who would then invest in more private investment. And they'd invest this private investment because the Fed would be creating money at a rapid rate, pushing interest rates down and making it easy for business to borrow. Another new economist, James Tobin, wrote, "The challenge of the 60s is to bring under public decision the broad allocation of national output." Now, that's a great little statement of macroeconomic socialism. To stimulate growth, we must engineer two shifts in the composition of actual and potential output. One is from private consumption to the public sector. The second shift of resources that must be engineered is from the private consumption to private investment. Increased taxation is the price of growth. So even though people think, when I think of Keynesians and the Kennedy administration and the new economists, they think of deficits. But that was only the first step in their plan to cure unemployment. Once that was done, then this whole plan for macroeconomic socialism would kick in. And that involved very high taxes. They go on to write, and they were very paranoid of the communist threat, of course. They wrote, "Our communist competitors have an advantage. Since they do not pay out increases in output in the first place, they do not have the problem of recapturing them in taxes or savings." So the government keeping your money is a problem for the government that you get paid. Okay, if they paid you directly instead of business, then they wouldn't have to have taxes. Okay, like the Soviet Union. Another statement by James Tobin, and which illustrates this war on private consumption. He says, "The unfilled needs of defense are great and they are urgent. For what more pressing purposes were these resources released?" So when Eisenhower was cutting his budget by $4 billion in 1958, he was releasing resources or giving back resources to the private sector. But Tobin wanted to know what were the high priorities? You know, why was he doing this? For research and development of new consumer luxuries, for new plants in which to produce more consumers' goods, old and new, all to be marketed by the most advanced techniques of mass persuasion to a people who already enjoyed the highest and most frivolous standard of living in history. This is the way he's treating the producers of this wealth, okay, as being frivolous. Military strength is not achieved by making civilian goods. Okay, that's the only true thing that he said in all that. Recently, a revisionist historian, intellectual historian, Robert Romani, exposed the intellectual arrogance and ideological biases of the New Economists. He wrote, theirs was an attitude, let me step back for a moment. How did they justify this grand program to cut back on private consumption and push it into other government-controlled sectors? They justified it by something called the social welfare function, which is a technical thing in economics. Paul Samuelson formulated it. And basically what it said was that you have to have values attached to economic analysis in order to come out with what the best policy is, in order to determine the best policy. But one of their number, Kenneth Arrow, who was also a New Economist, pointed out that under democratic voting, values cannot be ranked. There's a problem in trying to determine which policies are socially optimal, which improves social welfare the most. He pointed out that's impossible. Well, Samuelson and the other New Economists answered that and said, well, there's no perfect way of form of voting, voting system. But for the most part, since President Kennedy has won the election, most people share our values. They share the value of starving private consumption, of increasing the rate of growth, of fighting the Cold War. So that was how they answered it. And therefore, those were the values of the New Economists themselves, people from MIT and Harvard, that should be plugged in to the social welfare function. So Romani saw this, read this, and responded. Theirs was an attitude of apostolic zeal, overconfidence, and insufficient tolerance of rival approaches, which suited more an ethical creed than a scientific theory. Samuelson's policy texts, meant for the public or his peers, convey the impression that he was unearthing a set of eternal truths. The economist who thinks that his or her own values are also the electorate's is relieved of many qualms about conveying policy advice to a mass public. Okay? They're assuming that you guys want what they want, and therefore they can give you the policy advice, the technical policy advice on how best to achieve that. Okay? In the 1960s, when the country was united behind the Democratic leadership, or so it seemed, the New Economists could legitimately believe that they were participating in a major process of economic and social reform, developing and climaxing the New Deal, and were serving to achieve the nation's destiny. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, they really did believe this, and they were in power. They were at the president's elbow, as Heller said. I don't have much time left, but I'll just mention the unraveling of the New Economists' economics was caused by financing the Vietnam War. They wanted the president to raise taxes in 1965 when the war heated up, second half of 1965. Taxes weren't raised until Johnson put a surcharge on the income tax of corporations and households in 1968. So they didn't think monetary policy should be tightened at all to stop, because they saw that there was an inflation from 65 onward, there was an inflation. But they blamed it all on the government not raising taxes. Okay, said nothing about the money supply. In fact, they thought that the money supply was great. Okay, for example, Okun was in favor of easy money policy after 1966. He said by the beginning of 1967, the boom was no longer a threat. You believe that? inflation was beginning to rage. A tight money stabilization policy that once again put enormous pressure on financial markets would not have met social priorities. So they didn't want to tighten money to stop the inflation. What was the real cause of the boom? The real cause of the boom was the fact that under the Kennedy administration, the first 3 years of the Kennedy administration, the money supply went from about 3.5% on average under President Eisenhower to 8% during those 3 years, an average of 8%. So it was a monetary boom, of course, as we all know, as Austrians. So the Kennedy tax cut bill, now why didn't people realize this back then? It took a while for people to realize that it was really a monetary boom and not just not being able to pay for the war by raising taxes. Well, because the Kennedy tax cut bill receives a lion's share of the credit for stimulating the recovery of 1960. So they said, well, you cut taxes to get the economy going, you raise taxes to stop an inflationary boom. And also, like most economists since the 1930s, the new economists identified inflation with increases in the price level. So the price level was not increasing. I'll show you. So this is this graph shows the rate of increase in the money supply going from less than 4% under Eisenhower up to 8%. Okay, through 1969, and then dipping. And then shooting up under the Nixon administration. But it was 8% was a very rapid rate of growth of the money supply. But on the other hand, and I don't know how well you can see this, but from 1960 to about 1965, the price level was stable. So they thought that there was no inflation, that wasn't a problem. But inflation was going on from the beginning of the Kennedy administration. Okay, but they didn't realize it because they were looking at the price level and not the money supply. And they also believe that nominal interest rates would tell you if the money supply was increasing too rapidly. In other words, if interest rates were going down, then they would, yes, we should tighten money. But you can see that nominal interest rates were going up. So Keynesians, not believing in a real interest rate, at least not then, they hadn't absorbed the lesson that real interest rates are different from nominal interest rates, and that real interest rates fall when there's high rates of inflation. They said, look, interest rates are rising. Money's not too tight. Money's just right. Okay? Rather, money's not too loose. Money's actually getting tighter. Right? So they had all these weird reasons for basically a lack of social cohesion. Vietnam and the Civil Rights Act, this is what many of them said 10 years later, caused a breakdown in a social consensus that had backed Kennedy, and therefore you had different groups now warring to get a bigger share of the pie, and we weren't producing enough to meet everybody's demands, and that caused inflation. Okay, let me just sum up with Rothbard's obituary for the New Economics of Power. It says, the real slayer of Keynesianism came with the double-digit inflationary recession of 1973 to 1974, Since 1973-74, Keynesianism has been intellectually finished, dead from the neck up. Essentially then, shorn of its intellectual groundwork, Keynesianism has become the pure economics of power, committed only to keeping the establishment system going, babying things along through yet one more election, and hoping something will work, at least to preserve their cushy positions for a few more years. Fortunately, this whole idea of macroeconomic socialism or socialist planning has sort of died. We're back to the regular horrible Keynesianism, which is trying to fine-tune the economy. Okay, even though the theory has changed a lot, the policy, fiscal policy, and monetary policy is still Keynesian. Thank you.